Welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org, on Facebook and Twitter, and on our YouTube channel. I'm Dr. Stephen Krasner, professor of political science at Stanford University and a senior fellow at the Freeman Spogli Institute for International Studies and the Hoover Institution, and your moderator for today's program. And now it is my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker, Dr. Francis Fukuyama, senior fellow at Stanford University's Freeman Spogli Institute for International Studies, and author of the new book, Political Order and Political Decay, From the Industrial Revolution to the Globalization of Democracy. Dr. Fukuyama has written widely on issues in development and international politics, really on just about everything of importance in public life. He's one of America's leading public intellectuals, someone whose work is attended to by policymakers, the media, academics, and people like the members of the Commonwealth Club. His book, The End of History and the Last Man, which was published in 1992, has appeared in 20 foreign editions. It has almost 500,000 hits on Google. Between The End of History, Writing the End of History, and his present study of political order, he has published books on American democracy, biotechnology, and trust, as well as many articles and op-ed pieces. Frank received his BA from Cornell and his PhD from Stanford. He was a member of the policy planning staff at the United States Department of State early in his career and a member of the President's Council on Bioethics from 2001 to 2004. He is a member of the Board of Trustees of the RAND Corporation and the Board of Directors of the National Endowment of Democracy. And he builds his own furniture, flies his own drones, maintains his own cloud, and rides his motorcycle despite his wife's misgivings. Frank, welcome.
Well, thanks, Steve. It's really a pleasure to be introduced by a colleague of mine at the Freeman Spogli Institute, and it's great to be back at the Commonwealth Club, and I'm really impressed. I'm competing against the Giants, and here you are, so that's really terrific. We'll see when they, you know, get the next home run whether you can keep your mind on what I'm saying. But in any event, so I am very glad to have this opportunity to talk about the general state of politics in the world. And I think the place to start the discussion of the themes in my current book is actually with the year 2014 and what's going on. So between us, this has really been a bad year in terms of global instability. But I think the nature of instability in the different parts of the world illustrates some of the, you know, the themes in this story about political development, because I think the different parts of the world are actually very different from one another. So if you start with Eurasia, continent of Eurasia, at either end you've got big, consolidated, powerful states, authoritarian states, Russia and China, that have territorial ambitions. They're on the move. So this is a big problem for their neighbors, for American foreign policy. But in a certain sense, that's a very well-understood problem. This is the nature of diplomacy in the 19th and particularly the 20th century, where you make claims about, you know, your the people that speak your language living outside of your country and you want islands or whatever. It doesn't mean it's easy to solve, but it's a very familiar kind of problem. But there's another part of the world that Zbigniew Brzezinski used to refer to as the Arc of Crisis, which starts in North Africa, goes through sub-Saharan Africa, into the Arab Middle East, through Afghanistan, Pakistan, and all the way to the Indian border. And there, the political problem is almost the opposite. The problem there is not that you've got big, powerful, consolidated, threatening states, is that you have a complete political vacuum. And what's remarkable about this year is that you have Libya, Syria, Iraq, Yemen, all of these Arab countries that simultaneously are virtually failed states, where there's no central authority, where they cannot control the activity of jihadists on their own territory. Now, this is something we can discuss in the Q&A period. I am personally of the opinion that we have once again overreacted to ISIS. I actually do not believe that this group is that powerful or threatening, particularly to American national interest. The only reason they look that way is that everybody around them is so weak, and they basically do not have military organizations or police power to actually keep this group under check. And if you look at where Islamic terrorism has gone in the last few years, it's migrated precisely into the vacuum areas of the world where there's an absence of political authority. So they've gone into Africa, into the Sahel, into places like Cameroon or Mali or northern Nigeria. And again, the reason that they're in these places is not they're strong, but this is, you know, this is where there's no government that can stop them. In recognition of this fact, American foreign policy in this part of the world, ever since September 11th, has been focused on really one thing and one thing above all, which is nation building or state building in those countries that are afflicted by this kind of terrorism, because in the long run, that is the only way to control this sort of activity. We invaded Afghanistan and Iraq, and we also discovered that the only way you're ever going to get out of this involvement is by trying to leave behind a government that is capable of acting like a state should, which is to maintain a monopoly over its own territory. And it turns out we're not very good at it, unfortunately. This is the problem I call getting to Denmark, where Denmark is actually not a real country, but it's kind of a symbol for a country that's prosperous, democratic, low levels of corruption, well-governed, and so forth. And so we're constantly trying to take a country like Afghanistan or Iraq and turn it into some version of Denmark, and it doesn't work very well. And part of the reason, you know, so this is why I started this entire project. So this book is actually the second of two volumes. The first volume was published 3 years ago, The Origins of Political Order. And the reason that I embarked on this was it seemed to me as a political scientist, you know, if you ask the question, well, where do these basic institutions like the state or law or democracy come from, there ought to be a book where you can go and read about it. And I couldn't think of any that I had read in the course of my education. So, you know, here we are. That's the book I decided to write. So this is, I think, the central issue. Political order is really a central issue, this vacuum of political authority that exists in many parts of the world. And the question is, how did any state ever come to fill that vacuum and to develop strong modern institutions? Now, I guess because I'm a political science professor, I have to start with a few definitions. But we need to begin by understanding what political order is. And in my view, there's actually three critical baskets of institutions that you have to have. First institution is the state. The state is about power. The state is about having a legitimate monopoly of force over territory that can keep the peace, defend the community from foreign aggression, that can provide for infrastructure, basic public goods and services, healthcare, and so forth. If you don't have a state, you end up like Sierra Leone and Liberia right now in this terrible Ebola epidemic, because you don't have public health authorities that can actually quarantine people and provide medicines and, you know, do all of the things that public health officials are supposed to do. The second important set of institutions is the rule of law. The rule of law, to really be the rule of law, must apply to the most powerful actors in the society, the people with the guns or the coercive power. If the president or the prime minister, the king, whatever, can make up the rules as they go along, then that's not the rule of law. So the rule of law, I think, in its most fundamental sense, is a constraint on power. So the state is about building up and using power, but the law acts in the opposite direction. It's a fundamental constraint on power so that power is used according to rules that the community agrees on. And then finally, you've got democratic accountability, which are a set of procedures. I mean, this is the way we understand it today. It's a set of procedures, free and fair elections, by which you can try to ensure that the elite running the country is acting in the interest of the whole community and not just in their own narrow self-interest. And so there's a balancing act that has to go on in any modern political order between, on the one hand, the state, which is the power institution that uses and accumulates power, and on the other hand, the rule of law and democracy that are institutions that limit power and constrain power. And if you're at too far at either end of that spectrum and you're not balanced, you're not in a good situation. So At the far end, where you've only got constrained and no state, you've got Libya, basically, or Syria, or Somalia, or some other place where essentially anybody with an AK-47 can put together a militia and, you know, take whatever they want, and it's not very pleasant living in a place like that. On the other hand, if you have a powerful state but no instruments of constraint, you have an unbridled dictatorship, and that's basically China today, because China has a very long tradition of having a pretty modern, advanced, bureaucratic, centralized state, but they have very, very weak rule of law and, of course, no democracy. And that's not a good place to be either. And so you really want to have all three of these institutions, but they really need to be in some kind of a balance. Now, there's one other really critical definition, which I think is key to actually understanding a lot of what's going on in the world, and that is between a modern state and what has been called a patrimonial or a neo-patrimonial state. Those words come from the sociologist Max Weber. So in the old days, in the Middle Ages, when you had kingdoms, you had a patrimonial system in which there's no distinction between public and private. Basically, the king owns his domain, so if he wants to give a province away as a wedding present to his daughter, he can, you know, go ahead and do that. And under this system, there's no such thing as corruption because the king owns everything, and therefore there's no way you can violate public trust because there is no public, right? Today, there are no countries in the world in which the ruler gets up and says, yes, I just own this country. So what you have is a pretense of running a modern state. You've got a parliament and a president and a court system and so forth. But the reality is what political scientists call neo-patrimonialism. It's the pretense of having a modern state, but in fact, the state is just a collection of kleptocratic people that are in it to extract resources from the society. And the reason that you go into politics in a country like this is you want to get rich. You don't go into the private sector to get rich, you go into politics to get rich, because politics is essentially a means of sucking resources out. A modern state is very different, and you don't have to have democracy to be a modern state. A modern state is impersonal. It seeks to treat people equally on the basis of the fact that they're citizens, and therefore it should not matter in a modern state that you're like the cousin of the ruler. It shouldn't make any difference because the state seeks to treat you as a citizen and not with any particular favoritism. I would argue that the single important dividing line in the world now is between these patrimonial or neo-patrimonial states and modern states, and much less between democracies and authoritarian regimes. So we Americans love democracy. I love democracy. And we think about, you know, we categorize the countries in the world as to whether they're democratic or authoritarian. But I actually think that the fact of whether they're modern or patrimonial is actually a much more important dividing line these days. And I'll give you a few examples of this. So you take what went on in Ukraine earlier this year. As you remember, the elected president, Viktor Yanukovych, was driven from power last February by these demonstrators, these young demonstrators that wanted Ukraine to align with the European Union and not with Russia. So what was the issue that was involved in that struggle? I would argue that it was not democracy, because everybody, including those protesters, admitted that Yanukovych had been elected in a reasonably free and fair election. What they did not want was the degree of kleptocratic corruption that his regime represented. So I don't know if you saw any of the pictures of this palace that he was building outside of Kiev that was like six times the size of the White House. He was funneling billions of dollars of state resources to his family, getting it outside of Ukraine. And the entire system was essentially a little family-based cabal to suck resources out of the Ukrainian public sector. And these young people said, we don't want to live in a country like this. We want to live in Europe. And what Europe represents to them is a place in which there's a distinction between public interest and private interest, and where the government is supposed to serve public interest and not simply as a vehicle of enrichment. And I would say that's the big fight we're having with Putin right now. Because again, Putin was democratically elected. And if there is an election tomorrow in Russia, probably 70-80% of the Russian people would vote for him. So The question is really not democracy. It is the fact that Putin, like Yanukovych, is running one of these insider rackets where, you know, they're basically stripping resources from the state for their own self-benefit. They may use Russian nationalism, you know, to generate public support, but the essence of the regime is that kind of corruption. But there's other areas. So even in countries that are democratic, I think that this failure to achieve a modern state is also very critical. So take India. India is a very successful democracy, has been ever since independence in the late 1940s. There was a study that was done by Jean Drez, who is an economist and an activist, of education, primary school education, in several poor states in northern India. And he discovered that 50% of school teachers were not showing up for work despite the fact that they were being paid. So there's nobody in the world that thinks this is the right thing to do, right? So there's a big outcry. There's a free media in India. There's a lot of political opposition. There's efforts at reform. 10 years later, they do another survey, and they discover the percentage of school teachers not showing up for work is exactly the same. It's still 50%. So despite the fact that it's a democracy, that there's a free press, that there is political opposition, they cannot achieve this very basic goal of actually getting teachers they're paying to teach children. And that, you know, is a big problem for India because there's a huge education gap that really holds back the competitiveness of that society as a whole. Another example, actually Steve Krasner was a Peace Corps volunteer in Nigeria, so he knows this country. There is a public utility, as in many countries, that is called the Nigerian Electric Power Authority, which Nigerians say the initials NEPA actually stand for No Electric Power Anytime. And the reason is that it is horribly unreliable. It also is racked with corruption. If you're running a business in Nigeria, you know, the lights will go out at random times during the day, so you have to maintain a backup generator, which is extremely expensive, pollutes a lot, so on and so forth. Even if you get closer to Europe, why is it that Greece got into trouble during the recent euro crisis? So there are many reasons, including bad design of the European Union and of the monetary system as a whole. But one of the factors was that the Greeks could not control their public budget deficit. And part of the reason for that was that, as a democracy, the two competing political parties, as they traded, you know, after every election, they would trade positions. And what they spent their time doing was packing the public sector with their own officials, such that by the time you get to the late 2000s, the Greek public sector has something on the order of 7 times the per capita number of civil servants than Britain does in that same period. And that was one of the reasons they couldn't control their wage bill. And, you know, that's been one of the objects, is to try to stop this patronage system, which is really corrupting Greek politics. And so this is why I say, you know, so again, we Americans really love democracy, and we focus very much on democracy. But I would say that creating a democracy is actually much, much easier than creating a modern state. We've had several examples of this, you know, in the last decade. Iraq and Afghanistan are both democracies. They both had elections, or in Afghanistan's case, an election-like event recently took place. And so there's a lot of corruption and, you know, so forth. But they actually, you know, for a very poor country, they pulled something like an election off. What they do not have is a modern state. They do not have a state with authority to keep the peace, to build infrastructure, and both of these countries are so corrupt that they lack legitimacy, and that's one of the reasons they're facing these big insurgencies. And so getting to Denmark, if by Denmark you understand a modern state, that is a much, much harder task than simply getting to modern democracy. Now, a lot of my book actually focuses on the United States, and one thing that I think is important is for Americans and Europeans to understand that when you look at corruption, or what we interpret as corruption in developing countries, that we don't get too proud of ourselves, because in fact we have different forms of corruption, but in a certain sense we went through, you know, much of the same thing that, you know, I was describing, let's say, in India, which is this widespread patronage. And in fact, one of the arguments I make in the book is that, if you have democracy too early, or not too early, but if you have democracy before you've actually modernized your state, that actually is one of the sources of patronage and corruption in government. And the, you know, the single best example of this is the United States itself. In 1828, Andrew Jackson is elected president of the United States. This is a really pivotal election. He's running against John Quincy Adams. John Quincy Adams is a Boston Brahmin. He's the son of John Adams, the second president of the United States. He went to Harvard. He traveled in Europe as a young man. He could speak several European languages. Jackson, by contrast, grew up in a cabin in Frontier, Tennessee. He never had much of a formal education. He was a drinker, a brawler, an Indian fighter, and, as it turned out, the victor of the Battle of New Orleans in the War of 1812, which propelled him onto the national stage. And this was a classic fight in American politics where Jackson represented a populist streak. So they open up the franchise. Most states open up the franchise to all white males sometime in the 1820s. Now that all ordinary Americans can vote, who do they vote for? Do they vote for the Boston Brahmin or Andrew Jackson? They vote for Andrew Jackson because he's one of them. And he actually makes the argument, we shouldn't be ruled by people from Harvard and Yale. And it's actually very similar to the difference, I think, in contemporary politics between John Kerry, who was educated at Yale, and Sarah Palin, who basically argued that she didn't go to Harvard and Yale, and that's why you ought to vote for her. I'm serious about it. The Tea Party has a very, very deep root in American history, and really the first Tea Party person was, in some sense, Jackson. So Jackson comes to power, he's elected, and he says two things. I won the election, so I should get to decide who gets appointed to work as an official in the U.S. government. And secondly, I don't think that it takes a genius to run the American government. Any ordinary American can do it. And in particular, you don't have to be a graduate of Harvard or Yale to run the federal government. And this begins a 100-year period in American history that's alternatively known as the spoils system or the patronage system, in which from top to bottom, every office is filled as a result of a political payoff by a politician to some political supporter. If you read Abraham Lincoln's letters from early in both of his two terms, he is just inundated and is just driven crazy by the fact that he has to spend the first 6 months in office distributing patronage to people that supported him. And in fact, the Union Army loses several important early battles because it's led by a bunch of political generals. These are basically politicians that had no military background, but Lincoln felt he had to appoint them because that's what the patronage system demanded. And it isn't until, after Antietam that he finally figures out that he'd better appoint someone like Grant that can actually, be a military strategist and is appointed on the basis of merit. So it takes, a very painful experience to learn that lesson. And so this is the sense in which I think when we look at a place like Brazil or India or the Philippines that is subject to this kind of vote buying, we think, what's wrong with them? Don't these people understand what good government really is? And we don't understand that, in fact, at a certain stage in our history, when we were much poorer, less educated, and so forth, this was a system that we not only had, but we, in a certain sense, invented it. We got out of it also, I think, as a result of democracy, because by the 1880s, the country was changing tremendously. So up till then, it had been a largely rural, agrarian society. With the advent of the railroads, higher levels of education, more prosperity, a national market, the country starts urbanizing and industrializing. And it produces a very different social mix. And so in the early 1880s, there's a grassroots movement in favor of civil service reform. So you get all of these grandmothers that are just horribly angry that their fourth-class postmaster is some political hack that's been appointed by some politician, and they want change. There's good leadership in the form of people like Woodrow Wilson or Theodore Roosevelt, Gifford Pinchot. And then there's a triggering event, which was the assassination of James Garfield. And so Garfield is elected in 1882. He's assassinated by a guy that thinks he should be the consul to France and doesn't get the job. And so he goes, shoots the president. And Garfield takes 6 very painful weeks to die. And at this point, you know, nobody in Congress wants to change the system because they've all got a stake in it. That's how they got their own political power, was being able to appoint people. But this triggering event breaks the equilibrium. They're so embarrassed by what happened that they vote for something called the Pendleton Act that establishes the first U.S. Civil Service Commission, that establishes the principle that merit and civil service examinations ought to be the basis for hiring people and not simply, you know, this kind of political payola. Now, I want to conclude. So that's a happy story about how the United States actually peacefully and democratically arrives at, you know, much more modern impersonal government by the early 20th century. But I think the last part of my book on political decay has a very different theme, because I sort of think that the natural forces of rewarding friends and family, that I think is the natural form of human sociability, are very powerful. And in political systems, in political systems that want to be modern, over time, there's just a big effort to revert back to this form of you know, relationship. And I think that in a certain sense, this has happened. And so the United States pretty much banished the old forms of bribery and corruption that existed in the 19th century in the progressive era. So today, outright bribery, if you define that narrowly as an exchange of a quid pro quo, that's the legal definition, an explicit quid pro quo, that's not a big problem in the U.S. Congress. What is a big problem is a different form, which is essentially legalized gift exchange, where you give a nice donation to a congressman, and then 6 months later, oh, somehow the congressman decides to vote in favor of a piece of legislation that you want. And so it's as if we bar the thief from coming in the front door, and so he goes around the back and tries the basement window and the upstairs and you know, until he finds a place to get in. And I think that this has led to really decay of American political institutions. And here, I think, I'm not simply talking about the issue that a lot of other people are thinking about, which is polarization. That's a factor, right? But it's when polarization meets the particular characteristics of the American constitutional system that the problem becomes particularly severe. So the American founding fathers designed a system. They were worried about one thing above all, which was maximizing individual freedom and protecting individuals from tyranny, basically. So they designed an extremely complex constitutional system that separated and balanced political power, because they did not want power to be concentrated in a powerful executive, as it had been in the case of the British monarchy. That system worked reasonably well through much of the 20th century. The reason that it worked well, however, was that the two political parties for much of the century overlapped very substantially. And so, you know, great presidents like FDR or Reagan were able to achieve, you know, big changes in public policy. And by great, I just mean they did things. You know, they made big changes in public policy. The reason they could do that was, you know, you had a check and balance system, but there was also this high degree of convergence between the two parties, and you could form a coalition out of them. So now that's completely shot, right? The political scientists are pretty good at measuring this, that there's no overlap between the two parties. The most liberal Republican is now considerably more conservative than the most conservative Democrat. Again, that's not in itself a bad thing, because most European parties are ideological in that fashion. But when that combines with our check and balance system, it becomes very deadly, because we have what I describe in the book as a vetocracy. That vetocracy just means rule by veto. It's a more pejorative way of describing checks and balances. Our system makes it very easy for a very well-organized and well-resourced minority to stop things that the majority wants to do when it's not in their interest to do it. It does not promote consensus in making big decisions about, you know, complicated issues. So U.S. Congress has not passed a budget really since 2008. And last year, as you remember, we had a complete shutdown of the federal government because we couldn't agree on whether we should pay back our already incurred debts. And you may not know this, but actually under American law, if you were a federal official and you showed up at work, it was actually a criminal offense, right? So this is pretty dysfunctional. I mean, it seems to me the basic function of a government is actually to pass a budget every year, and Congress has not been able to do this. Or take another example, the tax code, which I think is a complete disgrace. You know, it runs to thousands of pages. You know, there's a big distinction between liberty and privilege. So liberty is a freedom that everybody enjoys. It's a freedom from government power that everybody enjoys because they're citizens. A privilege is freedom from government action that applies just to me and my family and maybe my company. And the tax code is full of privileges. So we have a very high marginal corporate tax rate, 35%. It's much higher than other industrialized countries, but many companies avoid paying it because they basically negotiated privileges for themselves. And that's why the tax code is that long. And everybody in Washington, if you ask them in the abstract, shouldn't we just lower the marginal tax rate and get rid of all of these exemptions and tax subsidies and so forth? They say, oh, yes, yes, that's a much more rational system. You cannot do it. You absolutely cannot do it today because of vetocracy, because it's just too easy for a powerful, well-organized interest to block anything that, you know, hurts us. I mean, that's why we still have this carried interest provision that allows hedge fund managers to pay a 15% tax rate. Not because, if you ask the American people, is this a good idea? It's because of vetocracy, that, you know, they're well organized enough that they can stop legislation that would eliminate that particular tax break. So this is, I think, now actually become a global problem. Xi Jinping and Vladimir Putin and Viktor Orban in Hungary and a number of other would-be authoritarian leaders would actually like my speech in a certain way. I mean, they get up and they say, yeah, you know, you're right that democracy in America and in Europe is not working well since the financial crisis and so forth. Look at us authoritarians. We are on the move. We've got decisive government. We can get things done where those countries can't. Now, I do not believe this for a minute because I think that all of these systems, these alternative authoritarian systems, have much graver weaknesses of legitimacy and long-term effectiveness. We can talk about this, you know, further in the Q&A, like what's wrong with China down the road and this sort of thing. But it's important that you know, the kind of image that America projects around the world, because its soft power is important. I don't think that we're facing a systemic crisis of American civilization. So the best part of America was never its government. It was really its private sector and innovation and, you know, entrepreneurship, and all that's really, really healthy in this country. I don't think that there's a generic problem with democracies, because there's actually quite a number of democracies around the world, in Germany, Scandinavia, the Commonwealth countries, Netherlands, so forth, that are working actually pretty well. There's very high levels of trust in government. They're making hard decisions and so forth. But it's this country, it's Italy, maybe Japan, you know, there are a number of countries, but this country is really important because the United States has always been a model for a successful, prosperous democracy. And I think if we don't get our act together, you know, the Xi Jinpings and Vladimir Putins are going to have more grist for their particular mill. So that's why I think it matters actually for global politics. So with that, I will stop talking. I look forward to your questions. Thank you very much.
Our thanks to Dr. Francis Fukuyama, Senior Fellow at Stanford University's Freeman Spogli Institute for International Studies and author of the new book, Political Order and Political Decay, From the Industrial Revolution to the Globalization of Democracy. It's now time for today's audience question period, and we have a number of questions, so let's begin. All right, the first and inescapable question, asked in several different ways. With great respect, wasn't your thesis about the end of history, the triumph of liberal democracy, incorrect?
Well, all right, so we have to back up to what the end of history hypothesis, it wasn't an assertion, it was a hypothesis, was about. And so the, you know, what I said was that for a good 150 years prior to the 1980s, most progressive intellectuals thought history had a direction, meaning it was pointing towards a certain kind of society, and that society was communism or some form of socialist utopia. And all I was arguing in 1989 when I first wrote the End of History article was that it didn't look like we would get there, that if we were pointing in any direction in terms of historical progress, it was pointing towards liberal democracy and some version of a market economy. And I think that's still basically correct. I think that, you know, I don't think that the Islamic State or Iran or North Korea are models for anybody. I don't think that we're all going to look like, you know, any one of those societies in another 50 years. The only country that I think is remotely plausible as an alternative model is China. And for a whole variety of reasons, I don't think that that's actually a sustainable model either. On the question of are we all going to be democratic tomorrow? No. On the other hand, you know, you got to step back a little bit. So in the year 1970, there were approximately 35 electoral democracies in the world. In 2014, according to our colleague Larry Diamond, there's about 110 to 115, right? So even with all the setbacks that have occurred in various countries over, you know, in Thailand and, you know, so forth in the last couple of years, democracy has done pretty well. It really is the default form of government for a majority of countries in the world today. So, yeah, I would change a lot of things in that original thesis, but, you know, the ultimate direction of history, I still think, is moving in that direction.
Thanks. So here there are several other questions about the general state of politics, both here and elsewhere. So are there systems other than democracy that would result in a modern state?
Well, so what I was trying to say with that tripartite description of what a political order should look like, the state itself can be modern. And the Chinese actually created a modern state in the 3rd century BC, if by modern we mean impersonal, bureaucratic, centralized, meritocratic, you know, so forth. But if you only have a modern state without either rule of law or democracy as constraints on the power of the state, what you end up with is a more perfect tyranny. And that's what the Chinese had. I mean, they invented an early form of totalitarian government more than 2,000 years ago, and that's still what they're pretty good at. So yes, you can have a modern state, but that's not a satisfying system. An unconstrained modern state is not a happy place, you know, for ordinary citizens to live under.
So is political decay inevitable? If so, what must be done in order to avoid the chances of chaos and disorder from evolving more quickly than institutional modernization?
The argument that I make in the book is that there's two sources of decay. So one is just rigidity, intellectual rigidity, that you have a certain set of institutions, and human beings, I think by nature, are very conservative. They worship their own institutions. They think that it has intrinsic value. You know, religion is a good example of that. So religion is a form of institution. It's a set of rules, and people don't discard religious beliefs just because they don't seem to be working, you know, practically. So that's one source. But the other source is the capture of the government by powerful elites. And this, you know, I gave several examples of this in the end of the Han Dynasty in China in the 3rd century AD, in the Ottoman Empire, and in France. You know, in France, under the old regime, the regime was so broke, the regime of Louis XIII and Louis XIV was so broke that they started actually selling off, literally selling off pieces of the state to rich individuals. So you could buy the office of treasurer of France for a certain sum of money, and then you could tax people on your own authority, and you could keep the taxes. And not only that, you could actually turn this office over to your children as part of their inheritance under a system called the Paulette. So political decay has happened repeatedly because I think it is just a kind of natural form of human sociability that keeps working against, you know, the maintenance of a modern political system. And I just think that because you're a democracy, And a modern industrialized country doesn't mean you're not subject to it over time. But one further point. So it may be that it's a constant threat. You do not have to succumb to it, because I think that one of the theories that's out there is that democracies are self-correcting in certain ways, that nobody wants their society to decay. And therefore, because of one man, one vote, if people see that elites are taking over the government or they have undue influence, they're going to vote them out of office and you'll get a different system. So that's the theory. And, you know, it's worked in the American system in the past, but there's no guarantee that it'll work in the future. And I think that's the thing we got to worry about.
So here's a direct follow-on question. What are the next generation of improvements and changes to democracy as a system slash institution?
Well, as it happens, we have a project at our little center in Stanford where we're kind of looking at, you know, not pie-in-the-sky kinds of reform. So I think that, you know, if you think you're going to have a new constitutional convention and, you know, dramatically remake, you know, for example, I actually think that parliamentary systems tend to work better than our presidential one, but we're never going to move to that system in a gazillion years. So I just don't think it's worth thinking about. But I do think that there are a number of things that you can do that would institutionally improve the performance of the government. And almost all of them have to do with getting rid of veto points or reducing the degree of polarization. Because if you remember, I said our problem is the intersection of polarization and vetocracy. And so, you know, what I would do, I'd get rid of the filibuster, I'd get rid of senatorial holds, I would actually streamline budgeting so that it is done by a super committee of a much smaller nature with much more technocratic input, and then you take the whole budget to the Congress in a single up and down vote the way the base closing commission did. You know, this is basically the way a parliamentary system works, and you can try to insert something like that into the American system. And then in terms of polarization, unfortunately, a lot of the things that produce polarization were actually put in place in order to increase levels of democratic participation, like popular primaries. I mean, if I could, I would abolish primaries, party primaries, and I go back to having the party, you know, secretariat pick the candidates, because, you know, they pick John Kennedy and Franklin Roosevelt and, you know, a lot of really great presidents, because they're all aiming for the median voter. But what we have in our country right now is a system where a combination of money, concentrated money, and a primary system in which only activists vote leads to, much more extreme candidates displacing much more centrist ones. And I think, so that's something I would replace, or you could replace it with, a different electoral system, something like the alternative vote, so that you can make third-party candidacies, you know, much more easy. So there's a whole list of things I think we could do that don't require constitutional change.
So here's a more general way of putting that last set of points. How do we give government enough power to be effective, but not enough to be corrupted?
So this, the Federalists, you know, the Founding Fathers posed the problem almost in those terms, that a government, you know, needs to be powerful enough, but, you know, who governs the government? I mean, who watches over the government? And that was the reason we have checks and balances. So I'm not proposing that you get rid of checks and balances. You fundamentally do need to divide power, because that's ultimately the big bulwark. So that's why we really want an independent judiciary and, you know, other kinds of institutional blocks. But I would put the problem in the following terms. I think that we are kind of trapped in a low-trust equilibrium where we have a political culture that at base doesn't trust the government. And this is not just true of the Tea Party people. I mean, a lot of people on the left don't trust the government. They think it's in the thrall of corporations, or, you know, it's too self-interested, or money makes too much of a difference, and so forth. And so we do two things. You know, we are reluctant to pay taxes to fund the government adequately, and we don't want to give it enough authority, because we say, you know, we're too worried about these people tyrannizing over us. And the government operates then without adequate resources and without adequate authority, and lo and behold, they don't do a good job. And then we turn around and say, see, the government can't do anything. And so I think you've got to break out of that. You've got to break out of that cycle into the opposite equilibrium, where the government has adequate resources and adequate authority, and can actually do things effectively that then builds trust. So it's interesting what's actually going on with Ebola in this country right now, because up until the current crisis, there's a lot of poll data that shows that the most expert sort of elitist parts of the government are actually also the most trusted by the American people. So the CDC used to be, you know, at the top of that list, and NASA and the U.S. military and, you know, the Federal Reserve. These are all institutions that are only kind of minimally under direct democratic control. So what do you think is the part of the U.S. government that is absolutely the least trusted by the American people? It's Congress, and particularly the House of Representatives. And so it's actually, you know, the part of the U.S. government that is the most directly under the control of the people of this country, which is an interesting result. So it's almost as if, you know, Americans kind of realize that they have to have expertise and a certain domain that's protected from politicization, so that, you know, and this is the terrible thing that's going on with Ebola right now, is that this becomes a political football. So instead of making decisions about how to deal with a public health emergency on the basis of, you know, medical expertise, you know, it becomes a political football. And this has happened in, you know, quite a few domains of government. And so I think that's kind of the way to think about it, that you need to figure out how to ultimately maintain democratic control so that the government is ultimately accountable. If it screws up, and, you know, the CDC looks like it has screwed up in the past couple of weeks, you know, there's accountability. You can change the head of it. You can, you know, get them to do something different, but you still have to protect a certain domain of authority where they can actually use expertise and you know, kind of knowledge-based, you know, rational decision-making to make public policy.
This is the Commonwealth Club of California, and we are talking with noted scholar Dr. Francis Fukuyama about political order and decay throughout the world. I'm Stephen Krasner, your moderator. You can hear Commonwealth Club programs on the radio, catch up with us on Facebook and Twitter, and see program videos on our YouTube channel. Frank, so here are a couple of more specific questions about the United States. Is the U.S. moving towards neo-patrimonialism in light of the huge amount of money needed to run for office?
The simple answer is yes. You know, the Supreme Court in its wisdom has said that money is basically a form of free speech, which is, I find, a kind of incomprehensible decision, but it's spoken, and therefore it's, you know, legislatively extremely hard to control it. I think, you know, there are a lot of people that say that you can't control money in politics, that it'll always find a way in, which is true only in the very broadest sense, but there are many other democracies in the world that have much stricter limits on the way that money enters into politics. So does it make a difference everywhere? Of course, but is it as important as it is in the United States? No. So I think that that's quite important. And that's, you know, it plays into the vitocracy story, because what the money does is it concentrates, you know, the power and the advocacy of interest groups, which collectively are not representative of the whole American people. They're representative of the most well-resourced and the best organized parts. And by the way, that's not all groups on the right. You know, some of them are groups on the left. You know, public sector unions, you know, are what prevent, I think, thoroughgoing civil service reform like we had during the Pendleton Act. So there, you know, there's things on both sides that, you know, that make interest groups very, very problematic. So I think that is an example of patrimonialism. It's basically rewarding yourself and your family and your friends because you are well organized and other people are not.
Here's another specific question about American politics. The manner in which healthcare reform was passed was controversial. Was that justified in the context of vetoocracy? How does that compare to other controversial major acts?
Well, that's actually a really great illustration of vetocracy at work. So it's true that Obama, it's not just Obamacare, but the Dodd-Frank Act, too. These were the two big major pieces of legislation that were passed in Obama's first term. I am in favor of both of them. I think they're both better than nothing, but they are both monstrosities. You know, both of these bills are hundreds of pages long. Most of the members of Congress voting for them have not read the entire bill. They don't know what's buried inside of them. Why are they so complicated? They are complicated because of vetocracy, because in order, even when the Democrats control the presidency in both houses of Congress, in order to generate a legislative majority that could pass a complex piece of legislation like Obamacare, you had to make all of these payoffs to pharmaceutical companies, doctors, insurers, you know, so forth, in order to generate the consensus that was needed to do that. And we've got this peculiar, you know, approach to legislating that really is very much due to our constitutional system that locates the authority to do this sort of thing in the legislature. In a parliamentary system in Europe, in Britain or in Germany or in France or in Sweden, the same legislation would have been drawn up in the government itself, probably in the health ministry together with the finance ministry. They would have put together a much more coherent piece of legislation. And then because you've got disciplined political parties, they would put it up for a vote, and it wouldn't be subject to kind of infinite, you know, log rolling and so forth. I mean, this is a real sore point with me. So there was an easy way to deal with the too-big-to-fail problem coming out of the financial crisis, which is basically to raise capital requirements on all banks, you know, to something like at least, let's say, 10, you know, maybe even 20% of total capital. Many, you know, experts think that this, you know, if they simply had switched those ratios and didn't permit the 20 or 30 to 1 leverage that existed before the crisis, that you really could have solved this. And you could have written this kind of, you know, regulation on a few sheets of paper. And I think it didn't happen because the banking lobby was just too powerful. So it's another example of vetocracy. You could pass Dodd-Frank, but, you know, you get this monstrosity because, you know, that's the only form, you know, that the regulation could take. And so that's why, yes, our system does ultimately get stuff done, but it doesn't get stuff done in anything like an optimal way. And basically, you know, the financial regulation that we've got now does not solve this too-big-to-fail problem. So we are still vulnerable to the same sorts of, you know, forces that led to the 2008 crisis.
Right. Let's move on to some other parts of the world now that we've solved all the problems for America. What prospects for the rule of law and democratic accountability do you see for China? More generally, how do you think of the success of the Chinese political system, and how do you predict its future? Will it replace the U.S. as the number one strong power in about 10 years, or let's even say in some longer period?
Well, I think the Chinese political system has got some big problems in terms of sustainability. Both their economic and their political models have got problems. The economic model has obviously got this issue, you know, that they need to switch from external to internal demand, and they're only partway there. They've privileged growth over environment or consumer safety, you know, to just a tremendous extent, so they've got huge liabilities in that regard. The political system, I think, is also extremely vulnerable. They don't have a dominant idea that legitimates them other than the fact that they're doing well, because half of it is Marxist-Leninist and half of it wants to be kind of traditional Chinese Confucian, and, you know, and the only actual, the thing that worries me about that society is there's no morality, I mean, other than kind of naked self-interest. And so you kind of wonder what's going to keep the society going. But in the political terms, the one really big problem that they haven't solved is what the Chinese call the problem of the bad emperor. So a good emperor in an authoritarian system is great because you can do stuff really fast. Deng Xiaoping switched the system from Maoism to some form of market, you know, based economics, and he did that much faster. You couldn't possibly do this in a democratic system in, you know, to the extent and the speed with which he did that. But if you got a bad emperor, you're really in trouble because there's no checks and balances in that system. And the thing about Xi Jinping, the current ruler, is he's undertaking this huge purge. He is now bidding fair to be the most powerful Chinese leader, maybe since Deng Xiaoping, or maybe even since Mao Zedong. And at this point, there are all sorts of theories as to whether he's a good or a bad emperor, and we don't know. And I think anyone that tells you one way or the other, they don't know either, because he's either going to be this visionary leader who liberalizes and modernizes the system, or he's going to be one of the worst tyrants since Mao. And at this point, we just can't tell. And I think that's the most fundamental liability of that system.
So we have a number of questions about the Middle East. How does the oil curse fit into your framework? And maybe you should say a little bit about what the oil curse is.
Yeah, so it's not just oil, it's a resource curse. Right, so any country that just gets stuff out of the ground and gets rich that way has got real problems for democratic accountability and corruption because, well, first of all, the resources themselves are a source of corruption, as in, you know, let's say Nigeria. But in terms of democratic accountability, it means you don't have to tax your own citizens. And once you've stopped taxing them, they have no hold over you. And that's why I think some of the most abusive, corrupt countries are oil-rich countries or countries with minerals and, you know, extractive industries and so forth. And I suppose I could use this as an excuse for why we quite haven't arrived at the end of history yet, because, you know, that wasn't counting all these countries that are sitting on these big stockpiles of copper and uranium and oil and natural gas and so forth. And frankly, you know, that is a big obstacle. So you look at Venezuela, Russia, Iran, all of these countries can get away with not being democracies because they're oil rich. This also shows the importance of institutions, because Norway is also oil rich, but it's very well governed. And the entire difference is that they've got very strong institutions, and you know, they've got a modern state that's not into this business of just sharing the oil resources among a very small elite. They've got a much better sense of public interest there.
It's another more specific Saudi Arabia question. The Saudis promote and finance fanaticism. Why can't the U.S. and others more openly criticize them?
Well, we may get to a point where that'll be possible because, you know, the United States could be oil independent of the Middle East in the next few years. I mean, this oil revolution that's going on in North Dakota and places like that is really amazing. And actually, to the extent that the oil curse promotes authoritarianism, the oil and gas revolution in this country actually are working in the opposite direction. So if we start exporting LNG, for example, out of the United States because of all the shale gas, that's really going to undercut Putin and his ability to threaten Ukraine and, you know, the Western Europeans by cutting off their gas. Yes, the Saudis, you know, have played this outsized role in world politics because they're sitting on all this oil, and I think to the extent that we can get free of that, that would, you know, free up a lot of our foreign policy.
Another Middle Eastern country. Is the Islamic Republic of Iran a modern state?
No. I think that, the reality of the Islamic State is not impersonal leadership, but, you have these elites whose power base is in the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps or in the Basij, which is a parallel paramilitary organization, or in, you know, the various hierarchies of the clerical hierarchy in that country. And they're basically one of these rent-sharing cartels as well. A lot of them, you know, there's a high degree of corruption in that system, and they're basically into this kind of rent distribution the way a lot of other oil-rich countries are. The one thing they've got going for them is that they do have an Islamic ideology that pushes against that. And actually, I think that, you know, although Sharia law is not popular in this country, it does serve actually as a brake on certain forms of bad behavior. And I actually think that one of the reasons that a lot of people in the Middle East want Sharia law is that their governments are so corrupt that they think, you know, any law would be better than nothing, you know, because these guys are just, they're so in it for themselves that they ought to have their hands cut off because they are thieves, you know. And actually, if you look at some of the corruption that exists in some of those countries, you sort of say, yeah, well, let's try cutting hands off for a while and see if that works a little better.
So beyond individual countries, here are a couple of more general questions about the Middle East. How do you view the major destabilization of that entire region? Is the recent destabilization in the Middle East the beginning of the end for Western-imposed borders and states in the Middle East?
Yeah, the latter question I don't have a real answer to. I think the broader issue was the following, that this is a region that has not been doing well economically, but it has been undergoing modernization, and it is developing a middle class. There's a lot of social change. There's a lot of urbanization. I think the Arab Spring in its early stages in Tunisia and Egypt was driven actually by young people that were connected and better educated, and you know they wanted a more open kind of society, and their autocratic regimes were blocking that. And that was kind of the fundamental thing. The regimes that were in place were dictatorships that had been around there for 40 years are completely crony capitalist, inward-looking, didn't provide opportunities for their people. And so it was a combustible mixture. So in a way, it's not surprising that that whole thing exploded. And I think it's a good case study in why you need institutions, because what you have is corruption, autocracy, popular anger that bursts to the surface. And if you're going to get to democracy, that anger has to be channeled into institutions. You have to have political parties. You have to have constitutional systems that provide rules for, you know, peaceful transfer of power. And that's the really hard thing. You know, that's the really hard thing, is getting from that mobilization, that initial mobilization, to the actual institutionalization of both a state and rule of law and democracy. And that's where, you know, they failed. But I got a whole chapter in the book about Europe's failure, because after the revolutions of 1848, it was another 100 years until Europe really got to democracy. So anyone that expects that this kind of thing is going to happen quickly, I think, doesn't appreciate how difficult it is.
Okay, last question on the Middle East, more about American policy prescriptions. Why should the U.S. insist on democracy in the Middle East, where democratic values go against local political history and culture? Shouldn't we be satisfied with just stable, friendly, and friendly regimes?
Well, that's a pretty hard question, because I think that actually the fact that we were settling for stability in a place like Egypt ultimately didn't buy stability. You know, we supported this autocratic regime that built up a lot of anti-American sentiment, and then it exploded in Tahrir Square, and a lot of those protesters were really angry at the United States for supporting a dictatorship. So I'm not sure that that's actually, you know, the proper way to go. So Iraq was the case where everybody thinks we're trying to impose democracy. Actually, that's not why we invaded Iraq. We invaded Iraq because we thought there was WMD there, and we were just wrong about that. Democracy was kind of an afterthought. And you're right, you know, it's not a good idea to invade countries to turn them democratic. That usually doesn't work. But on the other hand, should you support civil society groups that are facing an unlevel playing field in trying to get their point of view out, which is something the United States does? I think, you know, that's perfectly legitimate. That's not imposing democracy. That's just, you know, leveling the playing field. So I think there are forms of influence in favor of democracy. And people in the Middle East, there are people that want democracy there. So I think it's a complicated question, actually.
Thanks. Unfortunately, we've reached the point in our program where there is time for only one last question. This is a question about a place that's very different than the Middle East. How would you assess the state of political order in the California Republic? For instance, the several political reforms passed in recent years, such as open primaries, et cetera.
Well, it's a lot better than it was 5 years ago. So the reforms actually, I'm not sure about top two, whether that's going to do the job, but the redistricting is a very interesting experiment. I mean, it's crazy that we allow the political parties in most states to redistrict. It's completely crazy. So I think that's got to be an improvement. In terms of the budget and the general finances, you know, this is an interesting question about vetocracy, because now you've got single-party control of both houses and the governorship. And, you know, California's been able to do stuff that it hasn't been able to do for a long time, and I think that's probably overall a benefit. But if anybody thinks that California is out of the woods just because we're running an operating, you know, account surplus, you better think twice, because, you know, we've still got these enormous unfunded pension liabilities that have not come due, and the state, California, like many other states, is really good at keeping those off the books. And so there's actually some pretty painful choices that Californians are going to have to make in the future if, you know, if the state in the long run is actually going to run itself properly.
So our thanks to Dr. Francis Fukuyama, Senior Fellow. Senior Fellow at Stanford University's Freeman Spogli Institute and author of the new book, Political Order and Political Decay, From the Industrial Revolution to the Globalization of Democracy. We also thank our audiences here on radio, television, and the internet. We want to remind everyone here that copies of Dr. Fukuyama's book are on sale in the lobby, and he will be pleased to sign them outside this room after the program. I'm Dr. Stephen Krasner, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned.